Good afternoon. You're listening to Spotlight Health on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Elise Thatcher, and this is the first episode in our series on critical health issues. Today, we'll talk about the boost you could get if you have a specific purpose in life.
People with a purpose are 2.4 times less likely to develop Alzheimer's disease 7 years later if they're seniors.
We'll also dig into why food studies can get such different results, like how much coffee we should drink or whether chocolate is good or bad for you.
When the data that you're collecting through these food frequency questionnaires are somewhat unreliable, then you're really trying to get to a degree of accuracy that you can't get with these.
That's coming up on Spotlight Health. Vic Strecker is curious about what motivates people. He's a researcher at the University of Michigan School of Public Health, where he's also director for innovation and social entrepreneurship. Strecker, who's spent a lot of time in the Roaring Fork Valley, used to study a different angle on what decisions people make.
I'm a behavioral scientist, and I've been focusing on what I've always thought were some of the biggest public health problems. So I dove right in 30 years ago into the issue of smoking and helping people quit smoking and developing greater tobacco control measures, and worked in that area for 15 years. And it's such a fascinating area, really, because it's behavioral and physiological and political and economic. There's so many pieces to it. It keeps you busy for decades. And I still do that, and I do other work in obesity and stress management and other things. But over the years, I've started asking myself, why do people engage in these behaviors knowing that they're bad for them? Why are people so defensive about making changes? When we bring these up to people, you know, why do they kind of almost have this wall that goes up around them? And what I started realizing is that we really need to help people get through that wall in a way to see things more clearly. And one of the ways that we've found helps people reduce their defensiveness is when they start thinking about core values, things that mean the most in their lives. A purpose in life is simply, basically, it's your core value. It's an operationalization of your core values by giving them a goal. So it's kind of like, what do you care about the most? Maybe you care about your spouse or your children or your community and at work, what do you care most about? What are the things that you value most deeply? And then you basically set a goal around those, and that becomes a purpose in your life. And it turns out that people with a purpose are 2.4 times less likely to develop Alzheimer's disease 7 years later if they're seniors. And this, by the way, is after statistically controlling for age, gender, race, income, their health status, their health behaviors. It still comes out to be 2.4 times less likely in developing Alzheimer's. They're less likely to develop heart disease or stroke. Half as likely 10 years later to develop depression if they start out not depressed. So I could go on, but the health effects, the health benefits of having a purpose in life are the equivalent, in fact, far bigger, far more important than many of the health behaviors that I had been studying for so long, like quitting smoking or exercising more or eating right. And I thought, why don't we talk about this more in this society? So that's kind of what led me to start thinking about this a bit more. And while it's not kind of your standard health behavior, something I think, well, I'm going to wake up and make sure I work out this morning, I thought maybe it could be.
And that while you mentioned, it sounds like being reminded of our core values helps break it down.
I think it helps transcend the wall. One way is if your wall does break open, and in fact, Elizabeth Lesser wrote this wonderful book called Broken Open, and it's about people who have gone through very difficult times in their lives. They might have lost their job, lost a marriage. They might have gotten sick themselves. They might have lost a loved one. And when those people go through those very, very difficult times, their ego breaks. They get broken open. And Ram Dass, for example, in his early 60s, suffered a major stroke. And when Ram Dass suffered this stroke, he said, "Ego breaks open. Now I can see clearly." And so you can break this castle wall breaks open and you see things more clearly, you become less defensive, but we don't want those bad things to happen to us. And So one other way to do this is to actually transcend the wall by thinking more about what you care about most, your core values and your purpose in life.
How does a dung beetle come into this?
Well, I have a daughter who passed away 6 years ago, Julia, and she had received a heart transplant when she was one. She was one of the first children to ever get a new heart. She caught a virus out of the blue, and when she was about 6 months old, it attacked her heart. And it's just a standard chickenpox virus, but this happens with a very small number of people, thank goodness. And for her, her only hope of survival was getting a new heart. And she ended up getting one, and then she had a very big life. She actually spent a lot of time in Colorado, one of the best times that we would have. Every summer was going up to Independence Pass and hiking around there, jumping off some of those cliffs into the water, and things like that. But the bottom line is she passed away 6 years ago, and when that happened, I kind of lost my own purpose and my sense of direction. And I found that the only way that I could get back into the real world again, to see clearly again, was to repurpose my life. And one of my purposes, I decided, was to help other people develop purpose. So I decided to write a book called On Purpose. And it was a book I decided to write as a graphic novel. So I got an amazing illustrator to work with me, this Cajun guy, Cody Chamberlain, from Lafayette, Louisiana. And together we embarked on a 3-year journey to write this book. And a friend of mine who's a Hollywood screenwriter, as I was writing this, I'd never written anything like this, believe me, he said, well, this is kind of a journey. It's kind of a hero's journey, a Joseph Campbell type of journey. And every journey like that needs a sage. And this is a journey about myself. It was also a journey about philosophy and about science, because there's so much science now looking at the science of purpose in life, this very philosophical construct. But he said, you need a sage or an oracle. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, and then he pointed to Yoda, and he said, Yoda is the sage. I said, really? Like, oh, of course he is. He's a sage who brings Luke Skywalker through his journey. And I said, well, can a sage be anything then? He said, well, look, Jiminy Cricket is a sage to Pinocchio. And I thought, wow, it could be an insect. And I was in the British Museum. And, you know, half of the things, it seems like, in the British Museum are Egyptian. There are all these scarabs everywhere. And there was this scarab that looked like he was pushing, or she was pushing, the sun up over a castle wall. And I was using this castle wall as a metaphor for one's ego, just as we've been discussing. So I went to an Egyptologist there. Of course, they had one. I said, do you have any Egyptologists? Well, of course we do. And I just said, well, what is this scarab? They said, well, scarab was Khepri. Khepri was the number one god in ancient Egypt and was in charge of transformation and transcendence and rebirth. I thought, your goodness, really? And this sun that the scarab god was pushing up was the sun pushing up every morning, basically representing rebirth out of darkness. And I thought, wow, this is amazing. I'll use this as my sage. And the Egyptologist said, well, I don't know if you want to do that, because the model for the scarab god was the dung beetle. And I thought, you're joking. You mean ancient Egyptians would be walking along seeing this, you know, this dung beetle rolling this enormous ball of poop, going, yeah, that'll be our number one god. And I thought, well, if Jiminy Cricket can be a sage, so can Winston the dung beetle. So I gave Winston a backstory and put him into this book.
You've been listening to research scientist Vic Strecker, professor and director for innovation and social entrepreneurship at the University of Michigan School of Public Health. Let's take a quick break. This is Spotlight Health on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Elise Thatcher. Spotlight Health is our 6-part series on the top current health issues. To keep up with this and other Aspen Public Radio shows like Mountain Edition or Curated, find us on Facebook or Twitter. Aspen Public Radio, your news, your music, your station. Let's continue our conversation with Vic Strecker. He researches the effects of having a purpose in life and teaches at the University of Michigan School of Public Health. Strecker joined me by phone, and you may notice he sounds a little different than during the first part of our interview. We had some technical difficulties. I asked Strecker whether there's an increase in research on topics like purpose or having a meaning in life, because it sure seems that way.
There is an incredible trend. Just over the last couple of years, the number of people Googling purpose in life has doubled. It's really amazing. And the amount of research has doubled. There's also more interesting research now. It's not, you know, I don't want to demean any kind of research if it's well-done research. But, you know, in the past, it's been mainly survey research looking at cohorts of people over time and finding that people with a purpose do much, much better, less likely to develop stroke, less likely to develop Alzheimer's, to sleep better, have better sex, things like that. And there's really good research on that. But now, for example, one of our studies, we put people into MRI, magnetic resonance imaging, and literally study their brains while they're reciting their purposeful values in their life. And just that process, we're finding out what's going on in the brain, and then we follow people giving them accelerometers, biometric devices to measure how many steps they take, and finding, you know, amazing results from this and looking at mechanisms in the brain for what, you know, and how this works. People have been, Barbara Fredrickson at the University of North Carolina has been looking at biochemical assays, physiological assays of people, looking at antibody production and other kinds of antiviral production and inflammatory production as a result of having a high purpose in life or lower purpose. And so all of these things now are connecting with physiology, with more interesting ways of measuring and monitoring and understanding mechanisms, and even looking at telomeres, the ends of our chromosomes, we're finding that people develop purpose and then they have more telomerase, their enzyme that fuels the ends of our chromosomes, that repair our chromosomes, repair our DNA. So there's a lot more to be done, but oh my gosh, is this an interesting area.
Do we have a sense yet for why having a purpose can have all the health benefits you described?
That is the big question, isn't it? I think, in part, it is because people who have a stronger purpose start thinking about what it's going to take to live a big life. I'll give you an example. I try to teach every one of my students at the University of Michigan, and I have over 250 of them, as if every one of them were Julia, my own daughter. And by some really interesting coincidence, these children who are about 19, 20, 21 are the same age that Julia was when she died. So this allows me to kind of still be a part of that energy, quite honestly. But to teach every one of them as if they're my own daughter means that I'll see them at any time. I'll help them write a recommendation for medical school or graduate school. I'll talk to them if they have some problem in their life. I'll sit down and meet with them. So I need more energy. I need more self-control to do that. So I walk to work every day. I try to eat right. I try to sleep well. I try to be very present. So I meditate every day. I don't even allow myself an alcoholic beverage at the end of the day until I've meditated. And in doing that, I have become healthier. I've lost 20 pounds in doing that since I started this. So I find that having a purpose leads to trying to live a healthier life. That's important. And then you can go back evolutionarily, and it turns out that people with a purpose probably were selected for more often. We find even rats live empathic lives, that they'll share their food with fellow rats. They'll pull them out of cages to share chocolate chips, for example. There's all sorts of evidence suggesting through mathematical biology that evolution selects for people with a purpose. There's a lot more research to be done. We need to explore this more. But having a self-transcending purpose in life is clearly very good for you.
Vic Strecker, thanks for taking the time to talk.
It's such a pleasure. Thank you.
Professor and researcher Vic Strecker teaches at the School of Public Health at the University of Michigan. He's also author of the upcoming book, Life on Purpose, How Living for What Matters Most Changes Everything. That's out later this month. can be easy to get confused about which foods are good or bad for us because it seems nearly every day there's a new study that shows coffee is good or bad, or maybe we should only eat certain vegetables, and so on and so forth. Christy Ashwandin is lead science writer for 538, and she crunched the numbers on food and nutrition studies.
What we found is that almost every nutrition story that you will see in the news relies on the same couple of techniques that, when we looked into it, seem very flawed. And this isn't a new discovery by us. There are other researchers out there that have been making these criticisms. But basically, what it boils down to is this. It's extremely difficult to know what people are actually eating. And if you've ever tried to diet, you probably know this already. Just trying to keep track of what people are eating is difficult because there are measurement problems. So I can ask you what you ate for breakfast this morning. But if I say, okay, so if you had a bowl of cereal, how big was that bowl? What kind of cereal was it? Et cetera, et cetera. So that's the first problem. So what they do for most of these nutrition studies is they use a tool called the Food Frequency Questionnaire. And what this is just like it sounds, a questionnaire that asks people how frequently they eat certain foods. Here's a typical question. How often in the last 6 months did you eat tomatoes?
Oh, goodness. I don't know. Probably every other day, maybe?
So that's a very typical question on the food frequency questionnaire. So what others might be, how often did you eat yogurt? How often did you eat carrots and other mixed vegetables was a question on the one that we took. So anyway, based on these answers, which, you know, we've sort of established here may be unreliable, based on these answers, this is where they get those studies that say, you know, blueberries are good for you or coffee's bad for you, et cetera, et cetera.
I noticed there's a video posted with your article on this that it shows a guy blendering up some meat.
Yes. Yes. So one of the questions, so I should back up a moment. So one of the things that we did for this story is myself and several of my colleagues at 538, Walt Hickey and Anna Berry Jester, we all took a food frequency questionnaire. We hired one of these companies that does these for researchers. We took the food frequency questionnaire. We also recruited some readers to take it as well. And so one of the, and after we had done it, we sort of talked about it and joked about it. And one of the things that Walt remarked was that one of the questions was ribs, and they asked for our servings in cups. And, you know, you're looking at a plate of ribs and trying to ascertain how many cups it is was just sort of ridiculous. So, Walt commented that, you know, if he was really going to do this, he needed to put them in a blender. And so that's what he did. And we made a little video of it, and it was pretty gross, actually. But to be fair, some of the other questions, so for the bowl of cereal, for instance, there were these little visual pictures that came with it to help you sort of guesstimate. So you could look at the picture and say, okay, that looks like the kind of serving that I took. But again, these go back to the same problem, which is that you're relying on people's recall of their food and what they ate. And our memories are notoriously unreliable on this. There's actually some pretty good data on this where they compare in instances where they're really tracking someone very closely, and they look and they see that we know that people underreport some foods and overreport others. So like you might be inclined to say that you ate more vegetables than you really did. And really, you know, you never ever ate a whole bag of potato chips in one setting because naturally you wouldn't do that, right?
It sounds like eyewitness accounts, they're not as reliable as we might think they are.
That's right. That's right. And this is a real problem for nutrition research because it's not ridiculous to think that what we eat affects our health. We know that that's true. But when you start trying to break it down to a very granular level and say, okay, this particular food and this particular amount, like, is it healthy or unhealthy? What are some of the health outcomes or things that you're interested in? Becomes really difficult. And when the data that you're collecting through these food frequency questionnaires are somewhat unreliable, then you're really trying to get to a degree of accuracy that you can't get with these. And so another really important thing that we realized as we were doing this is that these food frequency questionnaires have so many questions on them, which they should. You know, if you really want to look at what people are eating, you need to ask them a lot of questions and ask them about a lot of foods. But what these questionnaires do is they create an enormous set of data. And, you know, that's good because you're looking for things, you want a lot of data, but it's also bad because what ends up happening is, so the food frequency questionnaire that we used in this story had over 1,000 different variables. And when you combine them together, that allowed us to do more than 27,000 analyses. And so just from a statistical point of view, you know, we ran this by some statisticians, just based on sort of the numbers in our data set, we were guaranteed to have at least something like 1,400 false positives. So that's 1,400 relationships that we could find on that data set that were just by chance that weren't actual true relationships because of the enormity of the data set. And so what happens is people do these food frequency questionnaires, they get an enormous data set, and they go back again and again, and they query it on things. And what happens is it's very easy to come up with spurious correlations. And so that's another thing that we did for this story. So we took the food frequency questionnaires ourselves, and then we asked some readers to take them. And then my colleague, Walt Hickey, came up with some sort of ridiculous questions that we asked later after the food frequency questionnaire to sort of do the same kind of analysis that's done with these food frequency questionnaires. So instead of asking about, you know, cancer or diabetes, things like that, we asked them whether they thought the movie Crash deserved to win Best Picture. We asked them, you know, if their math score was better than their verbal score on the SAT. We asked them, do you have an innie or an outie belly button, things like this. And so based on these questions, we were able to make all kinds of crazy correlations. And, you know, we did this just to prove the point that just because you found the correlation doesn't mean that it's true and doesn't mean that it's plausible.
So is the common saying true then, that you can't trust the news stories you're hearing or studies about what's healthy, what's not, and you shouldn't plan your diet around that?
I think that's right. The thing to understand here is that it's a very difficult problem. It's not that researchers are corrupt or that they're doing sloppy science. It's that it's a really difficult problem. And it's really easy to do studies that sort of come up with shoddy data, and you can find these spurious correlations. And if you find them and put too much faith in them, you can sort of build this whole house of cards on sort of a shaky, flimsy foundation. So I think that when it comes to assessing food and nutrition studies, one sort of rule of thumb is that if the study or the story is telling you about one very particular food type or food group, you should be very suspicious. You know, if it's saying non-fat milk versus full-fat milk, or you know, a particular kind of berry, for instance, that's probably going to be less reliable than something that is more broad and general, such as you know, eating a particular way, some sort of larger food group, or sugar, fat, something that is much broader. But there again, it's just, you know, the underlying data that are supporting these studies tend to be not that reliable. So I think, you know, some skepticism is called for here.
You've also written about the fraudulent study on the effect an openly gay person can have on perceptions about LGBT folks. Tell me more.
Sure. There was a study that got a lot of attention a little over a year ago that found that canvassing voters on gay rights and same-sex marriage could actually change people's minds. And this was a huge, huge finding, a really important finding, because what we know from most existing research on this sort of thing is that it's extremely difficult to change people's minds, especially on issues that have become sort of polarized like this. And so this study got a lot of attention. They found a very large effect that this canvassing had on voter opinion. It showed that, you know, these canvassers were able to change people's minds and sway them. People who had opposed same-sex marriage, after they talked to the canvasser, had changed their minds, and that this was a robust finding that lasted over time. And so it was a big deal, got a lot of attention. There was a This American Life episode about it. It made headlines all over. And then about a year ago, last May, a couple of graduate students were really interested in this result, and they wanted to sort of build on it and take it the next step and look at it in some other context. So this is something that happens in science a lot. You know, science builds on itself, and so you take one study, and then the next researcher may come along and try and take that finding and apply it to a different situation or build upon it. And so that's what these graduate students were doing. They were interested in the finding. They wanted to try and use it in a different context. And so they started to do this. And as they looked at the methods that had been published, they found some discrepancies. And the first thing that tipped them off was that the first study had an enormous response rate for the questionnaires. So what happened was the canvassers would go and talk to voters, and then later they would receive these questionnaires to ask them. So they were sort of asked before and after what their opinions were. And then they were asked, you know, say 6 months later about the opinions as well. And the response rates for these questionnaires was extremely high. And the graduate students were unable to replicate this. And so as they sort of dug further, it turned out, the first thing that they did was go to the company that had been hired to administer those questionnaires. And it turned out that they had never been hired. But the thing that's interesting here is that the canvassing actually happened. It's just that sort of the analysis of whether it worked or not was fraudulent. And this all sort of unraveled. But the question remained, because the canvassing itself was real. And these were advocacy groups that were doing this. And they really did want to know whether it worked. The graduate students who ended up uncovering the fraud decided to go back and test it again. So the researchers used the same protocol. The canvassers would go to someone's home, and these weren't conversations of, the canvasser wasn't telling them what to think. They were really conversations, and they were a lot of listening to the voter or to the person, who had brought them into their home to speak with them. Sometimes these conversations would last as long as 20 minutes. I believe that about 10 minutes was the average, but this was not just like a quick, here, let me tell you what to think, I'm giving you paper. They were very conversational. And in fact, the researchers put some videos online that you can see of some of these. And they're very fascinating, because what you see is that the canvasser is really listening to the person and sort of stating their opinion a little bit. Some of the canvassers were transgender. Most of them weren't. And what they found is that in about, I believe, 10% or so of the people, they were able to change the voters' minds. And the thing that's really interesting is that this was a lasting finding. So that when they went back like 6 months later and asked them again, it turns out that those changes of heart that they'd had about transgender people were lasting. And so that's a really important and very novel finding.
Those results are quite striking.
Yeah, it is quite striking. We're not entirely sure what's going on or why it was so effective. And one thing that's extremely interesting to me is that they also tested it with abortion. So they did two types of canvassing. What they found is that the same technique was not effective in abortion. And so it may be that transgender rights are something that are sort of new to the public conversation, and that people may be a little bit more open to having their minds changed now than something that's more entrenched.
Well, Christy Ashwandin, thanks for taking the time to talk.
Thank you so much for having me.
Christy Ashwandin is the lead science writer at 538. She joined us from the studios of KVNF in Peonia. I'm Elise Thatcher, and that's all for our first Spotlight Health episode. If you like the music you're hearing behind me right now, check out The Reflex on SoundCloud. You can listen to this and our following Spotlight Health episodes on our website, aspenpublicradio.org.